Okay, I think they're shutting the door. That must mean that everybody, if you put us all are aboard, we're supposed to be aboard, and might as well get started on this because I think this might be kind of a lively one for today. For those who are here for the first time, I'm Reverend Thurston from St. Olaf College, and we're dealing with whatever happened to, and John has suggested that some people might not be interested because that's all in the past, but that's what historians are supposed to do, is talk about the past. But what I'm trying to talk about this week are specific issues which are still very much alive. And this one is still very much alive, and then to do my usual commercial for the next day, tomorrow, which will be at 4 o'clock, it'll be on the charismatic movement, because there have been some changes and some developments there which I think are interesting, and there are always some perennial questions. And I found with the charismatic movement, most people are not indifferent to it. They either have very strong feelings one way or the other about it, and that always provides the basis, I think, for a good, lively kind of discussion. And I'd be happy to, you know, to start and bring in some information about that, because I've had the opportunity to, you know, to do some research and a lot of interviewing on that one, and then having some personal experiences with having two children who were directly involved with the movement for, you know, a considerable period of time, which I'll talk about tomorrow. Okay. Anyway, today I want to talk specifically, so you know what the agenda is, on four issues, maybe five, but I think the fourth issue really comes down to the combination of part A and B of part one. Talk about some about school prayer, although some of you may wish that that issue wouldn't have to come up again, because you remember we had a major national debate about that in March of this year, just a major one. I'll probably mention it again, but for instance, in Northfield, where I live, Senator Durenberger called up some friends in Northfield and gave them his 800 number in Washington, and also our other senator, Rudy Boschwitz's 800 number, and said, please tell your friends to call in and vote on this, you know, over the telephone, because they wanted statistics to show the other people on the other side where they stood. Both of our senators voted against the school prayer amendment. Both are deeply religious men. Durenberger is a Catholic, and Senator Boschwitz is Jewish, which would indicate there is no particular, denominational backing on that one. And, you know, Senator Weicker, the leader, was Episcopalian and so on. But anyway, school prayer, moment of silence, that we'll talk about because that's still pending. Equal access, that means shouldn't public schools be open after teaching hours for religious groups the way the chess club or the stamp collecting club is open for children and for their particular use? And I want to talk about that because that's really up to date. The Congress just passed a bill on that last week, and I can't, unless today's papers bring in something of what they did yesterday, I try to be up to date. That's one reason I was telling John I don't have any book on the board for today. This is all current information, and some people write quickly, and I wouldn't be surprised if Marty would have a book out on this in the next couple of weeks, because the old expression with Marty, and I say this with complete respect, and I would urge you sometime to listen to the tapes that he made that he has when he was here, but Marty has his own Book of the Month Club. He can crank them out. I think it's something like 32 books or something, and shows no signs of stopping. A wonderful thing with him, once he said he had to discipline himself not to write books. You know, if you've ever tried to write anything, it's just the opposite, isn't it? You have to discipline yourself to do it, to sit down there and look at that blank page. Oh my goodness, I have to put something on that, and get the momentum and the energy going, and all the rest of these things. And that's certainly true with me. The farther I, farther along I get, the harder it is to get up and start writing anymore. But Marty is like Old Man River, just keeps going, and it's all good stuff. And I, as I said before, I think the world is a better place because of a contribution with somebody like Marty. I was fortunate because two of his sons were at St. Olaf, and I got to know one especially well through the college newspaper. And anyway, enough of a tribute to Marty. Equal access is, children have the right to have religious kinds of informational meetings in school property, since they are all right there, and you don't have to bring them together after supper or Saturday morning or something, the way you would for the stamp collecting club. And then the other ones would be the ones that I think probably many of you want to discuss. Is it right to use taxpayers' funds to have public, in public, to have manger scenes or to sing Christmas carols in public schools at Christmas time? And there was a Supreme Court decision on that one, which came out just last December, just in Lynch versus Donnelly, just in time for Pawtucket, Rhode Island, if that rings a bell with any of you, Pawtucket, so that they could have their manger scene. But to show you how divided we are on this one, the vote in the Supreme Court was 5-4. And you can't get any more divided than that. And it wasn't along the usual conservative liberal lines in the Supreme Court that you have there. Okay, now, furor over religion, that's what I mean by religion in public. The first three deal with the public schools, and the other one deal with, you know, the public in general. And I have to ask, I think I mentioned it before, anybody here from either Rochester, Minnesota, or Sioux Falls? Because they've had some very lively, to put it mildly, debates there. And my students from Rochester tell me people still aren't talking to each other over the school board battle they had over manger scenes and carols in the public schools. A very, you know, very serious kind of thing. Okay. As I say, complicated issue, one which raises strong emotions and tends to polarize friends, families, and maybe even polarize audiences, you know, such as this. And the question is, you know, why so much bitterness? Why so much controversy over the expressions of our religious faith? Why can't the controversies be settled, or at least slowed down in speed and intensity? Why do cases keep before the Supreme Court keep multiplying rather than going down on this? I mention that because what's fascinating about this problem, the intensifying of the battles over religious expressions in public, is that it's growing rather than diminishing in this country. In the 19th century, the whole of the 19th century, one church-state case, I mean, of any consequence at all, came before the Supreme Court, just one. And now, you know, there are dozens of them, and they just keep, as I say, multiplying. The only significant church-state issue coming before the Supreme Court in the 19th century was over the Mormons and polygamy. That was a major case, to be sure, one of the landmarks in the whole question about American religious freedom. If it's our religious freedom to practice polygamy, who is the government under the First Amendment here, you see, not to let us have that kind of religious freedom? So that was the only one, the Reynolds case, as it was called at that time. But starting really about 1940, for reasons we don't have to go into, you can take a history of American constitutional law if you want to, you know, find out all the dates of these things, it has intensified greatly. Now, why the hubbub? I think there are sort of four reasons why there is much more intensity of feeling over this sort of thing. For one thing, contrasted to the 19th century, surely we are a much different kind of society than that of the 19th century. It's just like Terry was saying this morning, we can't, if we're going to have God be a warrior from the early part of the, you know, the early Jewish history, we want to transfer God over to be a warrior in 1984, we have to take a whole lot of other things along with it. We can't just transfer the kind of Hebrew society of that period over and say that since God was seen as a warrior then, God should be seen as a warrior now. The same thing is true here in this time. We have different commitments, we have different priorities, a whole new sort of additional fund of experience in problems concerning religious freedom that were not available in the 19th century. When the Mormon case was made, we didn't have a strong Catholic Church. We didn't have a significant Jewish population. We didn't have, you know, a wide variety of different organized religious bodies in this country. And for all practical purposes, we were pretty much evangelical Protestant, and therefore there wasn't the concern over religious freedom. And where there was concern, sometimes we simply intimidated people, as was done, for instance, with some Catholic and some Jewish groups at the time. A second factor why there is the hubbub today is, I think, we have a much different understanding or definition of what it means to be religious, what it means to be religious. Basically, in most of the early part of our history, it was going to church, you know, being a good Methodist or Presbyterian or Congregational Lutheran, whatever the case might be. It's a much more sophisticated understanding, I think, and it goes beyond what I call the organized communities of faith, or the churches. In the 19th century, if you had said, if you had asked or explained to a foreigner what does it mean to be religious in America, I think the foreigner would have, if he had looked here, would have said, it's basically, you know, being a good member of a church, an active member in the church, and that's simply no longer the case. That's very important, obviously, but it's not the whole thing anymore. And third, why the hubbub today, and I think this can be documented easily, we are much more contentious society, we are much more willing, or much more eager, I should say, to take disputes, as we like to say, all the way to the Supreme Court. How many times in your community or your county or state, whatever it might be, if somebody loses, you know, in a significant battle, we're going to fight this all the way to Washington. And we do. The Supreme Court, one reason the Supreme Court is having the difficulty it does is has its incredible, you know, workload, just, you know, piles and piles of, and in Minnesota they've recognized this one thing, and we've just created a new appellate court, or a court of appeals, one level before the state Supreme Court. And there is talk, who is it, Justice Berger, right? Chief Justice Berger every year comes up with a proposal, let's have a new appeals court, to take some of the load off, the workload off the Supreme Court. But today, everybody wants to take things all the way to the Supreme Court. We're a much more contentious society, and we aren't willing to sort of let what you might call the establishment or the usual leaders take, take the leadership itself. Okay. Ours is a society in which the legislatures, the Congress, play an important role, but they really aren't the final deciding, you know, decision makers in our society any longer, and because the Supreme Court has been given the task of being the final source of power in our country. It still comes down to nine people making the decisions in this country. You see, with the legislature, you can keep passing the buck. You can have a new law, you can repeal a law, you can go on and on, back and forth, as was done with civil rights cases, but this isn't the case with the Supreme Court. It's very difficult, extremely difficult, to overthrow a Supreme Court decision. The only sure way you can do that is to get a constitutional amendment, and there have only been, you know, very few of those since 26 amendments, and you can throw out the first 10 because they were the Bill of Rights, and then you can cancel out the 18th and 21st because they dealt with prohibition. What we're looking at really is only 14 amendments to the Constitution since 1789. And when you think of all the, 200-300 constitutional amendments are proposed in Congress every year. 200-300 are proposed every year, and about one every 10 years gets through. You see how difficult that is. And I say this not because I want to bring up the cause of ERA, but how difficult it was to get ERA through. You needed 38 states to approve. It got, 35? As I remembered, it got 35 and then, you know, failed. We thought for a long time ERA was, you know, on the way. It wouldn't get anywhere in the South, most people thought, but they expected that, but it even lost in Illinois, which everybody thought was an enlightened state. And I'm starting to editorialize, so I better not say any more about that. Okay, so that's another reason for the hubbub. We insist that our particular case is universal, so important it has to go to the Supreme Court, and people are willing to do this, and are make the financial sacrifices to do this. It takes almost $2 million in an ordinary case to go all the way through the Supreme Court, if you're going to, you know, really fight something through. That's an enormous amount of money. And where do you get this kind of money? Some people, I'm trying to think of a case where they just dropped it because they just didn't have the money to fight it all the way to the Supreme Court. Any attorneys here? I want to be sure. If you get your bill from your local friendly attorney, you're always surprised. Remember, it's like this TV ad for H&R Block, where you're sitting there waiting for your 1040 to come back from your H&R Block friendly accountant, and this one man, when he sees how much he owes, his hair goes straight up. Remember, and the same thing is true with the attorney's bills. All right. Now, I think those are reasons. Finally, we live in a world which is frightening, over which we have, and there are so many things over which we have very little control, and we want to hang on to some things which are very close to us. And one thing we can do something about is our schools. It's the one area where the federal government hasn't really taken over completely. And it's the one area where there is significant difference between, or among, I should say, the different schools, systems. There is still some flexibility and power on the local level for the local school boards in matter of taxes, curriculum, all these things, and a lot of people don't want to surrender that. And when they see somebody like Moral Majority on the one hand, or American Civil Liberties Union on the other hand, coming in and telling them how they must express their religious freedom or their religious faith, they get upset. Who is this Jerry Falwell, or who are these lawyers from New York telling us, you know, ACLU, telling us how we should run our, world in Rochester or Sioux Falls or Pawtucket, Rhode Island, or whatever the case might be? We don't like that, and one area where many people have drawn the battle lines, I'm sure you could all tell your own horror stories of school board elections in your communities where this is the case. And I think that's largely because we've seen so many things by necessity simply go to Washington for not necessarily for a solution, but at least for dealing with. Okay, so the question I want to deal with, and finally, after too long an introduction, should religious faith be expressed in public, in civic institutions, such as schools and public squares? I'm going to go through a point where I think most of us would agree some kind of religious expression is necessary, useful, but you know how to do it. How should this be done? Since you add the sort of the emotional dimension of the public schools, where you have your own children and you, you know, you feel you have this one time in their life where you can, you know, make an influence, have an influence on them. You want to make their religious experience in schools as, you know, as meaningful as possible. You can't just, this isn't just sort of a thing that lawyers are debating over in the state legislature or, you know, at the appeals court, but this is something which, you know, directly affects each of you as taxpayers and as parents. Because there's one thing about the public schools, no matter where you go in America, no matter how many children you do or don't have in public schools, no matter how young or how old you are, you're going to pay a lot of taxes, you know, to the public schools. In fact, the great majority of, you know, the local tax goes to the public school. We could debate that a long time, but all of us have an interest in one way or another in the public schools. I don't have to remind you of that on what's due on April 15th, Infernal Revenue Day, and it was very appropriate, wasn't it? 2 years ago in Minnesota, we had a major blizzard on April 15th, and people, people were saying the gods were angry or something was angry. Okay, first one, school prayer. We've been through it, and I don't want to sort of rehash all the old arguments that go with this, but I do want to explain what I've got up here as a part of explaining why the Supreme Court makes the kinds of decisions that it does. By what authority does the Supreme Court say that some bills, some laws, I should say, are constitutional and others aren't constitutional? They have to, you know, base their decisions, their rulings on the Constitution. And the First Amendment to the Constitution is the one place where there is any talk at all about organized religion in American life. And that's what I've got written, you know, at the first year. Two parts to the First Amendment so far as the Constitution and religion are good. No law respecting an establishment of religion, that is, there should be no state church of any kind in this country, as contrasted to Europe. All our experience by 1789, when the Constitution went into effect, was having state churches, because they came from England or Germany or France or the Scandinavian countries where they all had state churches. They didn't want that, so James Madison wrote that directly into the First Amendment. No law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. It's twofold. They call it the Establishment Clause and the Free Exercise Clause. Okay, the Establishment Clause is something. And both of these are negative. Both of these really are to protect citizens against government intrusion or government interference in their religious life. It's the enemy, in other words, that they saw in 1789 was the government coming in and regulating religious life. That's the key point. What Madison had in mind, and this was true with most of the officials of the time, was what he liked to call, you know, sort of a pluralistic society in which if you have many different churches in operation and flourishing, no one church could dominate. I should have brought it along. He has a famous quotation where if there was only one denomination, like in England there was just the Anglican one, there would be tyranny because some people would be forced to participate in communion or pay taxes against their conscience. One church country was bad. If you had two religions, they would be at each other's throat all the time, such as you had in Germany with the Lutherans and the Catholics, or the Catholics and the Calvinists, where you had good King Gustavus Adolphus deciding to spread the word of Lutheranism by the sword, which is not recommended in most evangelism programs, but that was the way it was done at that time. Okay, so they had just two there, and they were at each other's throats all the time. But Madison said, well, you have a lot of different churches, they balance each other off, and everybody learns to live in peace and harmony with one another. Okay, so that was the ideal to be written into the Constitution. What happened over the centuries, over the decades, I should say, was, as I suggested before, very little to rock the boat so far as conflicts with religious liberty in this country. Except for the Mormons, nobody really decided to fight this all the way to the Supreme Court. But starting in 1940, especially with what I call the sectarian groups, Jehovah's Witness, Seventh-day Adventists, and some of the others, we started getting more religious contention in these constitutional cases. The case that really touched it off, it's called West Virginia case, The Jehovah's Witness children refused in West Virginia to salute the flag in the opening, services, or that's not the right word, the opening exercises. That's what I want in public schools. I have to tell one funny one on that. Because of the whole business about the Pledge to Allegiance and saluting the flag. I was a year ago, my brother is in the Lions Club over in my hometown in Kenyon, and asked me to come over and talk to the happens to be the May meeting of the Lions Club there. And I hadn't been to a Lions Club meeting. I don't belong to Lions. It's a fine organization, so just you can't belong to everything. And at the beginning, I was sitting up towards the front where the speaker is supposed to sit, and they stood up and they had the Pledge of Allegiance. And I hadn't said the Pledge of Allegiance since, way, way back, and I'd forgotten about the under God thing, for instance, among other things, because we didn't have that. That was 1954 when the under God, clause was put in. And anyway, I went through this and I sort of mumbled, and then, when at the ending it said, "With liberty and justice for all," and I added loudly, "Amen." A few eyebrows went up and everything else, but I thought that was kind of revealing of what I thought the Pledge of Allegiance was all about. It's kind of a religious thing as well as anything else. Okay, so you start getting problems over Pledge of Allegiance, over saluting the flag, over Jehovah's Witness refuse to let their children have blood transfusions even if their life is at stake, and other kinds of things like this. So the court worked out a threefold test, and this is complicated, but it's necessary for our purposes here today. The Supreme Court worked out a threefold test on testing the constitutionality, concerning these two points, establishment and free exercise, and if any proposed law violated any one of these three, or all three, obviously, of these three tests, then that law was to be considered unconstitutional. I want to be sure that's clear, because it takes a long time to understand the logic of lawyers, and constitutional law can be very, very complicated. Okay, so if you have a law, let's say school prayer or Bible reading, the one that came up in New York State, or the whole business about conscientious objection to war, or should the local school district give money for transporting children to parochial schools as well as to public schools, because if there weren't a parochial school, you'd have to pay for their transportation to the public school anyway, and does that violate separation of church and state and all these different things, all kinds of examples that I'll give here. So they worked out a threefold test for any law that is being proposed, and if there's a challenge to the law, obviously then it has to meet these threefold tests. The Supreme Court said that any proposed law, for its primary effect, it must have a secular effect. It must not be aimed at advancing anything religious, but any law Congress passes has to have a secular effect. Congress is not in the business of helping the churches as such. That would be a state church kind of law, where in England, for instance, or in Scandinavian countries, wherever, the government pays the salaries of the clergy. That would be a law where the government aids the clergy, or takes care of their benefits and retirement and anything else. All right. Secondly, the primary effect of any proposed law must neither inhibit nor advance religion. The primary effect of a law must neither inhibit or advance religion. It should be neutral. This is the idea about neutrality. Okay. And third, any proposed law should not foster excessive entanglement. That is, it shouldn't get the government involved in deciding what's religious and what isn't religious. Let me give you a couple of examples of what I'm getting at here. I'm skipping through some of these. These would be mixed up in these things. Here we go, yeah. For instance, when there was a law proposed that would have representatives of religious institutions or churches, for instance, come on to school property to teach in what used to be called release time, you remember release time, then even though it was considered a good thing that students learn about religion and learn about the Bible, let's say, as literature, because it's so important in our Western culture and everything else, then that law was struck down because that was its primary effect was to advance the cause, in this particular case, of religion. On the other hand, if a local school district wanted to use taxpayers' money to transport children to parochial schools or to buy, let's say, textbooks in scientific areas but not in religious subjects, that was considered to be all right because you weren't advancing a religious cause in that particular case. And as I said before, the rationale always there is that if there weren't parochial schools, we talked about this yesterday a little bit, you remember with Catholic and Missouri Lutheran and some of the other Christian school things, if you didn't have the parochial schools in your district, you would have to pay for these children anyway, for their education. Therefore, it is permissible to pay for their, quote, non-religious kinds of expenses that come to the school. And that's been held up. You may not like it, but that's what the Supreme Court says, and that carries some weight altogether. All right. So, or to give an example here, how do you, on conscientious objectors, this is a classic case that's always given here, how do you decide if a young man who is applying for CO or conscientious objection status is truly sincere? How do you know he isn't just trying to get out of serving in the military? He's shirking his duty, that suddenly as the draft comes in, he suddenly becomes, like a Quaker. And he hadn't shown any signs of this really before. How do you test that sort of thing? Who makes the decisions on whether or not somebody is sincere? The government doesn't want to have to make qualitative kind of decisions on this sort of thing, and they have tried very hard to pass laws which don't give the government the authority to say some people, in a very real sense, are more sincere than others. They want to avoid, in other words, excessive entanglements on deciding this. So I'll give you another example. Maybe it's happened in some of your towns. Let's say, and this is happening, and it'll happen a little bit more, I don't know how much more, with Lutheran merger, but we've already got a case in Shakopee near where I live. Anybody from Shakopee? You want to be sure on this? Okay. They decided that the ALC, I guess it was, right, was much too liberal, the usual sort of things, and got involved, if you're from Minnesota, the whole business about Lutheran social services and that sort of thing. So they decided to pull out. Okay. Some people said, said no, and the dispute then became, who owns the property? A lot of Missouri churches went through this with AELC and so on and so forth. The Supreme Court does not want to get this involved in who really owns the property, who is the more orthodox of the groups. So they just sort of stay out and they say, let the churches themselves decide. Because why should nine people in Washington decide who is more orthodox, than others? So they try to avoid these kinds of things. All right. So you've got these three tests. And now finally, after about a half an hour, I want to get specifically into these specific cases. You remember in March, the administration pushed the school prayer amendment, and it was a major event, really, I think, in American history. The sectarians, especially the religious right that I talked about before, made it their number one priority. You remember, if you watched the newscasts and all the rest, this you would think that was almost something like the second coming to some of these people. They would have major rallies on the steps of the Capitol. There would be prayer vigils. There would be those who favored the amendment speaking all night in Congress. Sort of a quantitative approach, I guess, that they had here. There were bands. There were people with American flags. I don't know what the American flag had to do seriously with the prayer amendment, but there are certain symbols that people use to back their cause. And then I suggested Senator Durenberger called some of us to have us vote on this. Now, what was fascinating to me about the school prayer thing was what people who favored it expected the school prayer to do. This is where I think the rub comes in on it. What do they think the prayer would accomplish? Here I quote Pat Boone because he's well known in the evangelical circles, and it was a pamphlet which I received. He said, this is what Pat Boone said. I agreed to leave our school crusade to help pass the school prayer amendment because so many boys and girls need help today. Just look at some of the statistics. Illegitimate births among teenagers are up 24%, and teenage pregnancies are up 76%. Violence in schools is at an all-time high. During the past two decades, the suicide rate tripled. Drugs and alcohol abuse among teenagers is at an epidemic level. The cost of school of vandalism now exceeds the national total spending for textbooks. Clearly, far too many boys and girls are out of touch. They're troubled and confused, and teachers don't seem to be able to help either. They've had their hands tied by the government. But I believe God can help if we only give him a chance. That's why I hope you will join my fight. Now is the time to take action to restore to American school children the sacred right to pray. So why won't you please mail the 3 postcards, then to your 2 senators and to your congressman? I'm sure all of you get those mail things now, like I did with the interest rates and the bank things, you remember, and so on. You see what they expect to have the school prayer accomplish. I don't want to editorialize on it, but I think what Pat Boone said there was, very, very, very clear. Okay. They see the school prayer as more than simply an opportunity for children to, start the day with prayer. And the argument was that President Reagan makes, if Congress can start every day with prayer, why can't you have prayer, why can't you start the school children's day every day with prayer? Okay. Now let me draw from a piece here from the New Republic, a writer by the name of Charles Krauthammer, and he says something that I'd like to sort of emphasize here. He said, we have an instinctive feel, I think, in America that some expression of religious, commitment or religious interest in this country is appropriate. Nobody or very few people want to have all, semblances or evidence of religion in public life eliminated altogether. The question, there are some people, of course, who want lots and lots of expressions of religious faith expressed in public life, and there are some people who don't want any of it at all. There are the total secularists and the total, what we would call, the sectarians. And Krauthammer says that we would like to find some sort of middle ground, and that lives up to what I like to call my second law of history, Joerst's second law of history, and that is there's always room in the middle. Whenever you're in an argument, there's always room in the middle. And what I think the debate really about school prayer is all about is what kind of room in the middle is there? What is the something else? One thing that was put forward by Senator Baker, you remember the Senate Majority Leader, for this something else was a big phrase called rotational pluralism. I'll explain what that means. He argued that what should be allowed in the school prayer amendment would be for recognizing all the different religious groups in the classroom and then taking turns on presenting prayers each day for that, so that no group would be excluded. Rotational pluralism, recognizing that not everybody was, let's say, Mormon or Lutheran or Baptist or whatever, but that there should be some sort of rotational system allowing each child to recite her or his own special prayer on a given day. And that was floated up, or they say sent up on a flagpole, and to see if anybody would salute it. Congress shot it down. What was it, 57 to, or what's the opposite of 57 and maybe 30, 57 from 100 is, because every senator voted on the school prayer amendment. There were 100. 43, that was right, 57 to 43. And they needed 2/3 to carry it. That means they would need 68, and they got 43. Okay. But anyway, the rotational pluralism option was put forward. Krauthammer says this, and I think I would agree with him on this. This attempt at reasonableness, this idea, well, we have a pluralistic society, so let's let each group have its day of prayer, is as absurd as it is earnest. It yields the worst of both worlds, sectarian and secularist. If public prayer has any purpose, it is the bringing together of individuals in common devotion. Arrangement in which the Catholic recites his prayer one day, the Jew the next, the Baptist the next, is not an exercise in prayer, but in anthropology. That's a nice way of putting it. And I've got a wonderful piece here by Marty. I have to put in at this point, I always like to quote Marty. And he's saying in the Christian Century here about school prayer, he said, if they really want them, let them have it. Do we pray in the name of Jesus Christ our Lord? Chop that phrase off because there are Jews present. Fine. Is Judaism the same as Christianity, minus the last phrase of a prayer? He's referring to the Lord's Prayer, he said. That's a demeaning concept for both faiths and an interesting point for community conflict in the future. Now, he's saying, talking about the school prayer amendment, let them have it. I have no doubt that in this political year, 4 out of 5 Missouri Synod Lutherans would be in favor of school prayer. Let them have it. Let their children pray Unitarian prayers, Buddhist prayers, even Methodist prayers. Forms of unionism. If any of you know Missouri, that's one of the buzzwords in the Missouri question. Forms of unionism. They do not allow themselves even now, even to the point of not praying in churches with other Lutherans. What will they do with their second thoughts? Here is a good one. Let them have it. Let Southern Baptists who support this amendment have it. Southern Baptists really didn't support the amendment. Then let their families be transferred to Salt Lake County, Utah, where there were in 1980 3,434 Baptists. See what power they have to prevent school fairs from becoming Mormon, or the voluntary Bible from being the Book of Mormon. There are 381,008 Latter-day Saints there, not all of them pushy, but most of them reflexively prayerful in ways that would irritate Baptists. All right, even things up. Punish Mormons by transferring them to the Bronx, where there are 347 of them now, surrounded by 496,690 Catholics, not all of whose children are in the parochial schools. Let them have it. Let mainline Methodists, find that their children come home voluntarily shaped by aggressive fundamentalists, or fundamentalist kids find themselves outnumbered by liberals. You see the point. Once you get into excessive entanglement, that's the point. Once you get into excessive entanglement, then you're in real, in real trouble with this. Well, I see I don't have to labor this point with you. All right. But what's interesting is that the Supreme Court may not quite be done with this one yet, because this spring they decided to look at an Alabama school prayer case, which means that they may be ready to look at the whole thing all over again. You would think that they had settled it in the 1962 and 63 cases, but maybe not. You never know what's going to happen, because the lines are shifting in the Supreme Court on this one all the time. Okay. Now, the second one, moment of silence, the moment of silence controversy. This one hasn't been settled, and this is a very lively and complicated kind of case. The Supreme Court is going to rule on this probably next year to decide whether laws permitting a moment of silence for prayer or meditation were unconstitutional. And that seems to be the thing. Some people are saying, all right, we're not going to have a vocal prayer. We're not going to have a prepared prayer. We're not going to have this anthropological prayer where it's Methodist, if it's Tuesday, it's Methodists sort of thing. Anyway, you get the idea. They are going to allow a moment of silence with this sort of thing. And the Supreme Court will have to rule on this, because its rulings to date have barred only official vocal prayers. In fact, as many people who are critics of the moment of silence have argued, that students are free to pray on their own, silently or otherwise, in the schools today. So why does this have to be brought into the form of a law? Let me quote here, and I think it's a fascinating one, and some of my best friends of these are Baptists, John W. Baker. He's a member of the Baptist Joint Committee on Public Affairs. If you don't know Baptists, they feel very strongly about religious freedom. This is a very big issue with all Baptists. You want to get a Baptist going, start he or she talking about religious freedom. It's about like justification by grace through faith to a Lutheran. That'll get a Lutheran started anytime, and religious liberty for all kinds of reasons we don't have the time to go into here as a part of the Baptist thing. Okay, what does John Baker say about the status of prayer in the public schools right now? He says six things. A student may pray silently at any time or place. A student may pray vocally so long as his or her prayers do not interrupt the educational process or infringe on the religious liberty of fellow students. That's perfectly all right. Three, students may give thanks for their meals either silently or vocally, as long as the prayer is student-initiated and not school-sponsored. Four, students may carry their Bibles and use them for devotional reading, so long as that reading does not interfere with classroom work. Five, students may discuss their religious views with fellow students, but they must not depend either on the power of the school or the fact that the states provide a captive audience to carry out evangelization in the school itself. And I want to come to that when we come to equal access. That's the business about should the schools be allow proselytization or evangelism in the schools. Six, school boards, as we talked, may provide releasing students from school for religious education in off-campus locations. So if that's the case, then why the hubbub, why the furor, why are people even interested in moment of prayer, since here are six specific instances where students may pray in the public schools itself? Here, this is a little complicated. The charge is made that people in favor of the moment of silence are really trying to introduce prayer, through the back door or through an indirect kind of means, that they have sectarian purposes. But their sectarian purposes are camouflaged by their statements that the moment of silence is merely to ensure a quiet and orderly atmosphere, like when Uncle Norman presses the button, there, and we're all supposed to come to a reverential moment of silence before going on. And they would say that's all the critics say that's what the sectarians are using as camouflage for their own purposes.
sponsors also emphasize that the fact that children are not forced to pray, but they may sit quietly in their seats. How has it stood up with the court so far? The Tennessee, New Mexico, and New Jersey legislatures have moment of silence laws, and all have been thrown out as unconstitutional in federal courts. And there is a case pending now in Oklahoma for this. The critics of moment of silence say the courts have pierced the deceptive language of the moment of silence statutes and have looked at what occurs. And what they say occurs is a religious kind of observance altogether. And the courts have been careful in scrutinizing any type of religious activity in public schools for religious content, recognizing, you see, the impressionability of children, the pervasive peer pressure, and the child's perception of school authority. What they mean by those big words is that the child can't help but feel if other children are bowed with their heads down and their eyes closed, that that's what they're supposed to be doing too. Somebody 6 or 7 years old doesn't have that kind of discretionary power yet, and the peer pressure can be very, very strong. Or what happens when the teacher tells you that it's time for the moment of silence? And doesn't that, in a very real sense, endorse in the child's mind the fact that the teacher is endorsing prayer? That's going on. And the impressionability that leaves with that sort of thing. Okay. Yeah, that's what I'm saying here. Permitting students to pray in school is too easily seen, they say, by children as official approval of prayer and religion. Therefore, the courts have found, using the threefold criteria here, that by enacting moments of silent laws, the state has placed its seal of approval on religious activities, which is in clear violation, you see, of the First Amendment by this. Okay. Further, critics state on the moment of silence here, the most dangerous aspect of the moment of silence statutes is the potential for abuse, which exists in implementing such laws. The vague nature of these laws was intended by sponsors to avoid the constitutional ban on prayer. But this kind of confusion also forces teachers to decide, you see, what type of behavior will be allowed during the meditation period. I mean, what are you going to tell your children they're supposed to be doing if you're the teacher during this moment of silence? Should you just be sitting there? Should you be standing up? Should you have your head bowed? Should you have your eyes closed? And who is the teacher, you know, to make these kinds of decisions? This is getting into the entanglement thing again, and once people say that's the case, then obviously it's getting much too complicated. Okay, so much for a moment of silence. I want to summarize briefly the next one, the equal access, because I think there'll be some interest in the one on, especially the interest on the prayer and the mangers and the Christmas carols in the schools and in the public places. What's happened with equal access is that it awaits the signature of President Reagan. It's that far along. It needed the approval of both of two-thirds of both houses, the Senate, which passed it last March, and just last week the House passed it. And what's happening with equal access, it's not seen in the same light as a major bill, as a major controversy, the way the others were. Such a, if you want to call it a liberal group, as National Council of Churches has approved equal access. Whereas the Lutheran Council of USA, ELCUSA, some of you know, ELCUSA has come out against it. Some Baptists are for it, some Baptists are against it. Even the American Civil Liberties Union argues for the constitutionality or the desirability of equal access. That is, that after school is over, children who want to organize for religious discussions using public school property should have the right to do so. And there's no sense sort of going over the old arguments on this one, since, as I say, it's been passed. And there's no question but that President Reagan has said that he will sign it. And they may have it, just haven't seen it in the either the Wenatchee world or the, there's a lot of things that aren't in the Wenatchee world. All I get with the Twins are ahead of the whole league, and all I get is their line score. I mean, you know, first things first around here. It's been so long since the Twins have even been above 500 that we want to get those things, you know, straight. Okay. But the equal access bill hasn't passed. Now, just two things by way of dangers I see with this. It is, in a very, very real sense, a free speech kind of thing. And if in the my point with, in my own opinion, with equal access is this: if in its ideal form, this is what happens. You know, that's fine if children discuss without teachers or without paid public employee supervision. No teacher can be there. That's very important. Then, you know, fine. I mean, the argument that if the chess club or the stamp collecting club can have, South Wing 101 at 4 o'clock, why shouldn't, other groups have the same kind of opportunity? But there are two dangers, really, with it. And one is, what if they decide to have religious services? What if, for instance, you start having a baptism? And children will say that that's part of our religious concern. And so therefore, if there are some unbaptized children in school, maybe we should baptize them. I'm sensitive to this myself, and I'll talk about this tomorrow with my own, with the charismatics, because one, the major sort of kickoff for me that got me involved in the charismatic thing was my son, 14 years old, came home one day and said he wanted to be baptized. You know, well, he had been baptized, you know, when he was 6 weeks old at St. John's Lutheran Church, and no way was I going to have him be baptized. I said, if you want to have a rededication or something else like that, fine. But what happened, you know, was baptism happens in a school. Or the other one, and this is to me the more dangerous one, what happens if any kind of religious cult can come into the schools and start proselytizing or evangelizing? I talked last week about the Moonies, and they're children of God. There are divine light, Hare Krishna, the Way, if you know that one, comes in. And they could start proselytizing in the public schools, on this public school time. And in a very real sense, you have a captive audience. The children aren't aware of these different kinds of things. Some people have told me, for instance, that they have sent, this is a little different, I was talking about this yesterday, some of these para-church groups for young people, the teenagers will go to one of these and they come home and tell their parents that the people at this rally told us that Lutherans, you know, were doctrinally deviant, and they weren't scriptural and everything else. Well, you know, that could happen in this sort of thing, with the equal access thing, because a lot of people have trouble understanding what Lutherans are, and of course most Lutherans have the same problem. When you have everything from Haugi Lutherans to, you know, really high church, liturgical people and everything in between, but there is the, you know, there is the danger of having impressionable children being exposed to ideas which parents just as soon wouldn't have them exposed to. So you get the conflict here with this. And I would want to, baptism and cults is what I have for this. Now, the final one, mangers, the one in Pawtucket, Rhode Island, yeah.
Can we discuss that one
now? Sure, fine, let's go with equal access. I'd be glad to.
Where are the problems coming from? The districts that I've worked with over the years have had policy that a parent can walk up and say that I would like to use this room, whatever. You have non-profit categories, profit categories outside of regular school type of use.
Yeah, the problems come from this thing I was talking about, that some people, we've become so sensitized in our culture to any kind of threat to the rights of minorities that people will see equal access as the use of public property, therefore, and funded by taxpayers, as a violation of their right not to have any kind of entanglement at all. You see, in this kind of law, and there were some places where teachers themselves were involved in the direction of these discussions, and that they say those who didn't want that say that's an unfair advantage. Because teachers have the authority and the respect of their, you know, the children, usually, at least they're considered to be authority figures. And that's where the trouble for some people entered in. Because, as I say, if you could make this sort of a dispassionate, objective discussion about religion, that's one thing. But it could so easily get to be, you know, a rally, like a pep rally, really, for one particular denomination.
But here again, the local district will still have the option as to when they start to want to schedule it. School is out at 3, and they can wait until 5 to open the building up for the general public.
Yeah. And so I think,
kids should be away from there, and parents' rights should start to take effect then as to why are you staying up.
That's the rationale behind why the bill is passed. And what's obviously going to happen, I've got a long editorial here, I don't have time to read. What's going to happen is this one's going to go to the courts, you know, right away. And somebody, how was it, the David Broder from the Washington, Washington Post, says this: before you know it, there will be a test case, and some judge will have found a First Amendment pretext for barring all religious discussion from school property. And therefore, he sees it as the beginning of another round of, you know, legal contention. And one parent can hold out. Small town near where we live is near Strand. And they've always had, this leads right into the fourth point, they've always had Christmas carols, in their pageant. And my sister-in-law, taught public school music in the Ostrander first 8 grades, and there was one person of a non-Christian persuasion who said no, and it was clear she was going to protest this all the way, you know, that it took. So they had to sing things like Chestnuts and Rudolph and you know, that sort of thing. And that angered a lot of people. And yeah, I thought a hand back here, sure.
Does this equal access mean that someone can come and want to use any, has access to any rooms on a campus that they want to use?
But be public, we're talking about public property.
Yeah, like a school.
Yeah, public property, yeah. When you say any campus, I thought you meant
private. Well, I meant on any rooms
sure.
on the campus.
Well, I think there would be some rules against using laboratories with expensive equipment,
okay.
Right offhand.
But, yeah. I run 3 different rooms with labs, and
yeah.
We've had community groups
yeah.
come in.
Yeah, they mess
and,
it up.
And once we had it, and it was like the next day, I'd
yeah.
have to spend an hour
yeah.
straightening stuff out.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like my home, and I don't
sure.
want these intruders
yeah.
coming into my rooms.
Yep.
And I think of other teachers that have files with tests, papers, and all. It's, you know, your office there, and people
they
come in and ransack through the stuff.
They would say that's a procedural rather than a substantive issue. But
local,
it's
local administrator.
Local administrator.
But it's still.
Yeah,
like
it's a real one.
From a teacher's point of view.
Oh boy, how would you like to have somebody come in and use your kitchen? I'll just give you an example right offhand. You know, I would agree with you on that.
I have 6 kitchens there.
6 kitchens, right, yeah.
And
I knew the first time my children were getting older was that I came home one day and everything was in the place that it had been when I left. I couldn't, you remember what a nice feeling that was? When with the little ones, you come home, you never know where things are going to be. Yeah, and I knew they were growing up when they didn't move things around. That was a nice feeling. But that's a procedural question, but it's a real one, right? Because these things are expensive, and I wouldn't want people in home. You're talking about home ec?
Yeah, but
yeah.
I think a shop,
you bet. Oh,
class,
yeah, right.
And even
yeah,
isn't
sure.
Class.
Any classroom.
Any class, yeah, we all have expensive,
yeah.
you know, computers
yeah.
in there.
You'd have to lock it up, and sure. But that's a procedural point, which I think, whatever you say, would be done on the...
Yeah, I would think, you know, I would say most schools operate, as far as public use, they put them into rooms where
yeah.
there is, you know, isn't much access to equipment or whatever,
yeah.
there's chairs and
yeah.
blackboard, and that's about it.
But that, I would agree with you, and I wouldn't want people fooling around in my, you know, with my things. So, oh, okay, now...
What about distribution of literature?
That wasn't spelled out in the, that wasn't spelled out, but that gets into the proselytization thing. Would the way be allowed to distribute literature at some of these things? They're all, it's fraught with, you know, with danger, that one. And I think it would be, the school boards would have to be very vigilant on that one, as to what's happening, yeah.
What about basketball?
Oh, that's a real one. What's happened is that, and I can only, you know, the examples I know, each denomination has the right to have its own baccalaureate services, which they can say are baccalaureate services, but they can't receive, they'd be wise not to receive any taxpayers, you know, funds to pay for it, if they wanted, you know, something like special music or programs or something else like that. Because there can't be any official baccalaureate service any longer, which is considered to be just as important, where you require attendance, just as you require attendance for commencement. Yeah, that's been changed.
In Portland, it was thrown out.
Yeah.
Completely.
Yeah, and then of course Portland has a problem with the statue on the hill, and you light it up for Christmas, and I heard Veterans Day.
That's Eugene.
That's Eugene. That's okay. Not Portland, Eugene. Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. But that's where I think where baccalaureate is now. Right. John.
One of the things that I dislike about public prayer in schools is the way to begin class is that I see it used. My Missouri Synod experience, I see prayer used as a way of gaining control of students and behavior.
Every head bowed, every eye closed. Yeah.
Well, none of that, but you use that, you use their religion as a technique for forcing your classroom order on the
yeah.
children. And so the God that's presented there is a God of, you got to be afraid, God's paying attention
right.
now. God's one who you have to do everything right for.
Right.
It's a legalistic form
very
of
much.
God that's used
yeah.
in that.
Yeah.
It's not.
Yeah.
It doesn't even have to be intended.
Right.
But that's the way it comes
yeah.
across when
right.
it's used as a way of creating order in the classroom.
Yeah. Keep the guilt on them, right?
And
Lutherans
and
are good. Yeah. Lutherans
yeah.
are good at heaping guilt on people, right?
I heard the Pat Boone statement, you know, saying what we really want to do is to regain moral control of our schools and our children, and that somehow public prayer at the beginning of schools is going to do that, and that's what I hear.
Yeah, right. And you can have the God of a God of punishment and a God of judgment, and that's, you know, if children don't have the discretionary powers to sort that out, they wouldn't understand anything what Terry's been telling us this week about, you know, the powers of God. And but if they hear that, that's a good point. With this, okay. What happened in Pawtucket was that the Rhode Island was that a life-size nativity scene was placed using public funds, you know, in the public downtown square. Several residents argued that public funds were being used to finance a religious and denominational observance, and that the government was advancing the beliefs of one religion contrary to the prohibitions of this in the First Amendment. Attorneys for Pawtucket, those who are in favor of the nativity scene, urged the Supreme Court to uphold the nativity scene for the same reason that the court upheld a disputed case in Nebraska where they paid public funds to pay for the chaplain at the state legislature. And that was done as a case, and this is done, I think, somewhere else. Okay. Now, this one is the Supreme Court, Lynch versus Donnelly, and the basic argument was written, or the decision was written by Chief Justice Berger. He argued the nativity scene is a long-standing tradition. That really is the key. It's a long-standing tradition. A depiction of Jesus in the manger, so went the argument, was a recognition of, quote, a religious tradition in this country which is interwoven with a secular celebration. That's the point here. And it is true that Christmas, you see, day is the only religious holiday which is also a legal holiday in this country. All the other legal holidays that we have in this country are, you know, Labor Day or Memorial Day, 4th of July, New Year's Day. Those are legal holidays, but they are not religious holidays, but Christmas is. So Christmas has, what the Supreme Court argues, Christmas has a special status, and we have to recognize its special status. Christmas, according to the Supreme Court decision, is, quote, a secular folk festival in America akin to Thanksgiving. And in March, the Supreme Court concurred 5-4. Well, what about the three, points here? Chief Justice Berger said these were useful guidelines, but they were not mandatory or binding on the Supreme Court. In other words, the Supreme Court does what it wants to do. That's the conclusion on this one, 5-4. And I think you can see the cases against this one that go on. We've got about 5 minutes. Anybody want to talk about that one, or about carols in the Christmas carols in the schools? The argument that some people put forward is that Christmas carols are, you know, a part of the secular folk festival we call Christmas also, and that the children don't really understand, or are they promoting or forwarding any specific denominational sort of thing. That Christmas carols have just simply become a part of the landscape. I could say it's like in a room where there's a wallpaper. It's just there, you know, and it doesn't really change anything. But this one got to be a knockdown, drag-out fight in, as I say, Sioux Falls and in Rochester. And it indicates, you know, where the conflict is going on in America and why the public schools are at the center, really, of the question of how religion should be expressed at all in our public life, and how contentious it all is, and how emotional the whole thing is. But, you know, that would be my finale here, but I want to at least certainly have plenty of time for more comments. Sure.
In the early 50s, when I was in elementary school, I was a Christian minority. I think there were 6 of us left in the classroom, and the speaker came, and 2 of them were Buddhist. And so, but we sang at Christmas time, we sang Hanukkah songs, mm-hmm. and Christmas carols, and we were sort of made sure that we didn't trample on each other. And we had conservative Reform Jews. I don't think there were any Orthodox, but there didn't seem to be a problem. And this was, you know, going back 30 years ago.
That's what's changed in that time, because, as I say, we're a much more contentious society and much more sensitive to, you know, in this case, minority needs. And aren't willing to sort of go along with the flow any longer with this. And I think my own feeling is something seriously has been lost there.
Yeah, that's fun. I learned a lot of things. We never sang
funeral
songs.
And my son, for instance, was in New York, and we all celebrated Hanukkah, a little bit before Christmas. And he learned an appreciation there, you know, from the school that I certainly couldn't have given him, because I didn't know anything about it. But they had people of that persuasion, you know, with that, and I thought that was, a helpful, you know, instructional tool. And maybe they were better off because they knew something about it.
but you know, difficult, you know, kinds of times. And then there are those who say the best thing to do is just not get the government into any kind of religious, you know, expression at all. Just throw it out altogether. And clearly, and that would have the advantage of being of efficiency, but it would also violate, I think, the desires, you know, of a lot of people. And if this is a government, if this is a kind of a government that, you know, reflects what we would like, why shouldn't we have the right to have some of our, you know, feelings and our expressions, you know, expressed? And that it's an everlasting question. We have a government by the majority, but still there are always the rights of the minorities with this sort of thing. Right. Okay, let's split here. I'm getting hungry, as I always do about this time of day, and we'll see you tomorrow. Good.